Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With your smartphone, your emails, your always-on-call job, and maybe a jam-packed family schedule, we wouldn't blame you for thinking modern society is more exhausted than ever. But in reality, exhaustion, physical, mental, even spiritual, has been a human preoccupation since the Greeks blamed it on a buildup of black bile. This hour on Point, we're taking a moment to talk about exhaustion. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. It's August. Are you all refreshed? Do you know exhaustion? What's the source? What do you blame for exhaustion? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Paris is Anna-Katrina Schaffner, author of Exhaustion, A History. She's a professor of comparative literature and medical humanities at the University of Kent in the United Kingdom. For an excerpt from her book, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Anna-Katrina Schaffner, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Great to have you. You define exhaustion on a very wide scale here, physical, mental, spiritual, even cultural. Is there no boundary to the exhaustion that you're describing?
Yes, basically I'm very interested in the different ways in which exhaustion and its symptoms have been described. And I understand exhaustion as a state which has physical, mental, and social dimensions. So basically there are physical symptoms that include fatigue, weakness, and lethargy. And then there are mental symptoms which include weariness, disillusionment, hopelessness, lack of engagement, cognitive impairment and irritability, and they're also typical behaviors that are associated with exhaustion that include restlessness and the avoidance of activity, effort, and challenges. And what I find really interesting is the different ways in which exhaustion has been explained throughout history. And sometimes theorists privilege the importance of the psychological dimension. Sometimes they emphasize in particular the physical origins of exhaustion. And sometimes they blame exhaustion on social factors, on cultural factors.
Are we more exhausted at whatever level you want to define that than our ancestors, our very recent ones, or even our ancient ones? How does one measure that?
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question, really. I think we certainly talk more about exhaustion nowadays. I think talking about being stressed, being burned out, being depressed, being exhausted in all kinds of different forms has quite a lot of cultural purchase. It has become acceptable. It has even become a way of, you know, establishing contacts with others. It has become a way of emphasizing one's importance in a certain sense because, you know, when you're stressed, that means you're very much in demand. Your life is very full. Your life is very active. You're popular. You know, things will break down if you're not there. And of course, you know, the medical men and women and psychologists and sociologists are extremely interested in phenomena such as depression, exhaustion, burnout, and stress. So I think there's a lot of talk about exhaustion. But whether we are more exhausted than our ancestors is really impossible to say. I think a lot of current researchers claim that ours is the most exhausting age ever, and they blame our particular exhaustion on, you know, a faster pace of life, on new technologies such as email, social media, mobile phones, and so on. They say that, you know, those kind of technological innovations, which were supposed to have made our lives easier, have actually made it, they have created new psychosocial stressors. They have made it more stressful in certain ways because we can no longer switch off. We're always reachable, which means that the boundaries between work and leisure have become quite porous. Mm-hmm. But whether we're more exhausted or not, I doubt it. I doubt it because what I found in my when I did the research for my book was really that every age was interested in the phenomenon, and there were medical treatises on exhaustion ranging back all the way to classical antiquity. So I think exhaustion really is a ubiquitous and timeless human preoccupation, and our ancestors have worried about it too. They have explained it in very different terms, but they have certainly been concerned about it.
Give us some examples of how ancestors described exhaustion that we might compare to our own summaries or depictions these days. Take us where you will, to the Greeks or as far back as you want to go, but what are some sort of points of comparison we might hear you share with us that would give us a sense of how they felt about being wiped out?
Yes. I mean, there are the different medical models that the theorists use to explain exhaustion, but then there were also, the voices of the exhausted describing their exhaustion. And I found that in those descriptions of the exhausted, there are a lot of parallels to what we would feel nowadays. I mean, I can read you a very, very short extract from a 19th century manual by an American physician called Weir Mitchell, Silas Weir Mitchell.
Yep.
And he wrote a treatise on exhaustion. He's the guy who invented the infamous rest cure. And he wrote a treatise with the fantastic title Wear and Tear, or Hints for the Overworked.
Okay.
And he argued that the core symptom of the overworked brain really is that it becomes unable to rest, which is paradoxical. So he wrote, at least we stop and propose to find rest in bed. Not so, says the ill-used brain, now morbidly awake. And whether we will or not, the mind keeps turning over and over the work of the day, the business or legal problem, or mumbling, so to speak, some wearisome question in a fashion made useless by the denial of full attention. Or else the imagination soars away with the unrestful energy of a demon, conjuring up an endless procession of broken images and disconnected thoughts so that sleep is utterly banished. And I think this is quite a powerful description of feeling too tired to sleep feels like still nowadays. And that was written in the 19th century. And of course, going back even further, I found some wonderful descriptions of exhausted monks who became very, very tired.
I love the phrase
tired.
Itself, exhausted monks. Okay.
Yes.
What was the problem? Too many potatoes to dig up or what?
Well, they were exhausted by their spiritual work.
Oh.
And that is another interesting constant in exhaustion theories, that a lot of exhaustion theorists are particularly interested in the exhausting in the ways in which brain work can be exhausting. So I focused mainly in my research on kinds of exhaustion that are not just physical, but they're somewhere located between the mental and the physical and the social, and that cannot be easily explained with too much work or any underlying diseases or illness. So I'm interested in the kind of chronic states of exhaustion that have no clear origin, and a lot of theorists focus on the importance of brain work and how brain work is very, very draining and dangerously exhausting in its own way. And the exhausted monks, I think there are some wonderful descriptions of what they did, because
yes,
that very much reminded me of replacement activities and us constantly checking our email and Twitter accounts, and they did something very similar. I'm just going to read a very brief passage
good.
From a monk called John Cassian, who lived in the sort of 5th century in a monastery in Bethlehem, and he talked a lot about acedia. He talked about exhaustion in the context of acedia. Acedia was a theological version of melancholia, and interestingly, acedia was thought to be a sin. So the exhausted monks were blamed for their behavior.
Let's hear
they
it.
Were basically they were basically accused of having very weak willpower and giving in to the temptations of demons or the flesh, and they were ultimately considered to be lacking in faith. So I'm just going to read that very short passage. So those monks were afflicted by such bodily weariness and longing for food that they seem to themselves worn out and wearied, as if with a long journey or some very heavy work, or as if that particular monk had put off taking food during a fast of 2 or 3 days. Then besides this, the monk looks about anxiously this way and that, and sighs that none of the brethren come to see him, and often goes in and out of his cell, and frequently gazes up at the sun, as if it was too slow in setting, and so a kind of unreasonable confusion of mind takes possession of him like some foul darkness, and makes him idle and useless for every spiritual work, so that he imagines that no cure for so terrible an attack can be found in anything except visiting some of the brethren or in the solace of sleep alone. And basically, Cassian describes the physical symptoms of acedia in terms of what we would now call post-exertion malaise or a bodily fatigue that is as intense as that experienced after very long fasting, hard labor, or extended walking.
But they describe it as a moral failing or indication of a lack of faith. Sometimes today, as you describe it, we're almost celebrating this state, like, oh, I'm so intensely engaged, I'm exhausted.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the exhaustion is generally viewed as something that is ultimately in one way or another positive, with the big exception nowadays and also throughout history, with the big exception of the medieval period, when acedia or later sloth was thought of as one of the deadly sins, one of the seven deadly sins. And sloth back then is not just laziness. It's a much more complicated concept that has a lot to do with spiritual engagement, a sort of lukewarm, cowardly, lack of faith, lack of commitment to, you know, living a productive, healthy, and spiritually correct life. And there were quite a lot of medieval theologians, including Aquinas, who thought of acedia as the worst of the seven deadly sins, the origin of all the other sins, really.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about human beings and exhaustion. What's going on when we're wiped out? How humans have understood, perceived exhaustion across the centuries. My guest is Anna-Katrina Schaffner. Her new book is Exhaustion, A History. She's a professor of comparative literature and medical humanities at the University of Kent in the UK. You can join us. Do you see exhaustion as a steady state across eras? Are we more exhausted now with 24-hour social media and work always at our fingertips, never saying no to overtime or trying to get ahead? How do you see exhaustion in your life, in our culture? People get exhausted. They talk about it. Sometimes they use it as their explanation for things that are just kind of off the rails. This is from ABC News a couple of years back. Demi Moore checked herself into a medical facility for treatment of exhaustion after her divorce from Ashton Kutcher.
Late Monday night, a 911 call from Demi Moore's mansion. The star was rushed to a hospital in Los Angeles after paramedics spent more than half an hour at her home. Moore's representatives tell ABC News in a statement, because of the stresses in her life right now, Demi has chosen to seek professional assistance to treat her exhaustion and improve her overall health.
Have you ever called 911 for exhaustion? What an idea. Anna-Katrina Schaffner joins us from Paris. Here's one response from online, if I may share it with you, Anna. Hello Kitty writes, frankly, I feel exhausted all the time. I don't remember the last time I felt refreshed. Everything Ms. Schaffner just described about exhaustion is how I would describe myself. I think I'm so exhausted because my lifestyle of working every day, 9 to 5, in an office with my phone buzzing, email streaming in, it's unnatural to my character. I think I'm the type of human being that is more in tune with my animal side, and I miss being outside in nature. I hate these false concrete jungles we've constructed for ourselves. I never feel my time is my own. Yes, indeed, I am exhausted. It sounds almost like the very modern model of how we think about our exhaustion. Describe it and its origins, Anna.
Absolutely, yeah, that's a wonderful example, I think, of what a lot of us feel. And I do by no means wish to diminish, you know, the exhaustion factors in our present period. But what I think is interesting is that we always tend to think of our age as the most exhausting ever. We think it has a unique status, you know, that none of our ancestors were exhausted at all, and that they all lived in harmony with nature. They lived, you know, in harmony with the sea. Seasons in the time of
frolicking
freeze.
In meadows,
and exactly. You know, and having lots of rest and spending a lot of time out there in nature. And to a certain extent, that is true. But they also faced unique challenges, and they also had very, very specific cultural factors that made them anxious. And they had medical models that, you know, that sort of shaped the kind of exhaustion they felt back then. And I just wanted to emphasize in my work that basically we think of our exhaustion as unique, but exhaustion really is a ubiquitous human concern, which is very much, I think, related to some psychological constants. And that is the fear of aging, fear of death, and also fear about the waning of our engagement. And I think that is something we can find in every historical period. Now, that's not to say that, you know, email and our particular precarious working arrangements, enhanced competition in, you know, in the neoliberal capital system, especially the Anglo-Americans, isn't exhausting. I fully accept that they are. I've suffered from exhaustion myself. And I do find, you know, a sort of full inbox that keeps becoming fuller and fuller, very, very threatening.
But when I think of what they faced in the past, where they had to chop all the wood and, you know, go out and do so many things by hand. I mean, here's another listener who writes, at least our world believes in leisure and vacations. A couple hundred years ago, those were unheard of. Your leisure time was Sunday, sitting in church, and the work week was 6 days a week, Anna.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very good point, because, you know, and in the 19th century, factory workers, they had horrible working hours, horrible working conditions. And I would by no means want to swap with them. I think I prefer being threatened by my inbox. You know, I think in the past there were also very, very unique and threatening challenges. And even if you go back to the 60s, you know, the threat of the Cold War must have made a lot of people very anxious and feeling very, very stressed about, you know, the possibility
mushroom clouds
of nuclear
and complete
catastrophe.
Destruction, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think what is very interesting is that in every period, people represent their own age as the most exhausting. So even that is not unique to our age. You know, even the ancient Greeks felt, you know, looked back nostalgically to times that were even further in the past. And they said, oh, nowadays our lives are so busy and so stressful. In the 18th century, you know.
How can that be, though? The ancient Greeks, we see them on the sides of their pottery, on the ancient Grecian urns, and they're always running and leaping and chasing animals through the woods. They look very vigorous.
Yeah, well, I think the people who write about exhaustion, see, they tend to be the scholars or the physicians or, you know, basically people who are brain workers in one way or another. And Aristotle already, you know, talked about melancholia, and he also introduced the idea that melancholia only strikes the exceptional, you know, only the very talented,
special.
The genius.
That's sort of like our celebration of it, right?
Absolutely. I think that's a very ancient trope, you know, that we're kind of breathing new life into it by saying, oh, I'm so stressed because I'm special and popular.
Aristotle,
and
get off our turf. We're faster. Lawrence in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, you're on with Anna-Katrina Schafter in Paris.
Hi, Tom, and on a very interesting conversation. This may be a function of my own exhaustion blindness, perhaps, but I'm wondering if this glorification, reification of exhaustion is unique to industrialized societies, American society, Western cultures, particular genders, or I hear that it's historical, but I'm wondering if there are certain contextual factors that help us better understand why some people seem to wear it as a badge of honor in a perverse kind of way.
It's a great question, Lawrence. What about geographically or cross-culturally, Anna? Does it have different stature, status in different cultures?
Yeah, well, I would say that in Eastern cultures, like, you know, in China and in India, there exists a concept of human energy that is still in use. So the Chinese speak about qi,
yes.
Life energy, mm-hmm. Which is also a cosmic energy, but also a very sort of specific mental and physical type of energy. And they have a very, very well-developed system of relaxation, and they take very good care of their energy. You know, they're very concerned with making sure that one's energy levels stay constant. Here in Paris, for example, whenever I go into the parks, I see huge groups of people practicing Qigong, you know, which mm-hmm. is an ancient Chinese
kind of Tai
practice.
Chi almost.
Yeah, for enhancing one's energy level, for liberating the free flow of Qi. And in the Indian tradition, of course, you have prana and yoga. In yoga, that's mm-hmm. a central concept. Our culture doesn't have a widely accepted model of human energy, which I think is really, really interesting.
But it did. I mean, you write about Marsilio Ficino and him talking about this world soul, a kind of quintessence of the world soul, and even encouraging, what did he call it, Orphic dancing,
yes.
To imitate the or approximate the movement of the spheres or something.
Yes, absolutely. Ficino was a very, very interesting Italian Renaissance scholar, and he was very interested in astrology and astronomy and magic, and he believed that our energy levels are influenced by the planets. So he felt that in order to live in a vital, energy-rich life, we have to align our own energies with our, with the planets that matter in our horoscope. You know, for example, if you're born under the sign of Saturn, as the melancholics are, and he's very interested in the melancholics because he was one himself, and it's the melancholics who suffer from exhaustion symptoms.
But he also wants you to take pills here, frankincense and myrrh and saffron,
yes,
and cinnamon and citron peel and red coral.
Yeah, he was interested in alchemy, and he came up with lots of concoctions and cures. And he, like most exhaustion theorists, was very interested in diet. So he had a lot of very specific dietary recommendations. But he basically believed that if we live in harmony with the planets that are important in our horoscope, then our energy levels can flourish. And if we live against them, we struggle against cosmic universal forces, then we will be drained of all of our energies because they're all wasted in this struggle, basically.
Well, what about Lawrence's question then? If we look around at contemporary cultures today, do you see a greater celebration or susceptibility to this notion of exhaustion in the West versus the East, in the U.S. versus Europe?
Yeah. I think I'm German, and in Germany, the Germans are obsessed with burnout at the moment. It's incredible. Whenever you open a newspaper or you turn on the television, there's a discussion about burnout. And they're very anxious about how the current working environment might impact on our well-being, on our psychological and physical well-being. And they constantly review legislation to make sure that workers are, protected, and that the new kind of working environment doesn't become too harmful. My brother, for example, works for Mercedes, and he mm-hmm. told me they have email policies in place that are there to protect workers from feeling stressed. So when they go on holidays, their email accounts shut down so that people don't return to
awesome.
A massive amount of emails in their inbox.
Just
and at VW, I think you can't access your work email after hours, to make sure that people only work a maximum of 10 hours a day. And I think quite a lot of companies in Germany take that quite seriously, and they try to police that in one way or another. And I would say, answering Lawrence's question, is I would say that the Germans and some of the northern European countries like the Netherlands and Sweden, they're very, very interested in burnout, and there are very lively discussions about it. The Americans, I think, are probably also quite interested in stress and burnout. And then there are other cultures in which those discussions aren't very, very dominant and very, not very noticeable. So there definitely are cultural differences. And I think they relate to, you know, the kind of importance of work in a given culture, the status it has. And in Asian cultures, I think, you know, people are just more used to being very careful about their energy levels, and there are very specific cures for lack of energy in place.
Or maybe it's about cultural cycles. I mean, first of all, I must say, well, Americans talk a lot about exhaustion, sure. We don't talk about as much about solutions in this country as you may in Northern Europe. I don't know, but maybe, Chinese don't feel exhausted because their culture has been on this tremendous upswing. You know, you introduced this notion of being late in the cycle of the Roman Empire or late 19th century Europe when they had the sense of the century and era ending. Maybe that's exhausting.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the cultural and the social factor in individual exhaustion is another thing I found really interesting because I think if you're living in a culture that is optimistic and thriving and growing and expanding, then that might also color cultural debates. That might also mean that, you know, people report less on negative news stories, more on positive ones. And that really, the role of the social in well-being is really interesting. It's very hard to clearly define, but there are certainly cycles when a culture is basically in decline, like 19th century France. You find a lot of discussions of ennui and degeneration and decadence, and that cultural climate really colored debates. And I think at the moment that there is probably a sense of, you know, of a frustration with neoliberal capitalism and how it really, really drains us of all of our energies, and we're getting quite not that much back. So I think at the moment, you know, the cultural climate will also significantly contribute to the rise and fall of certain diagnoses. I mean, if you look at the, you know, depression diagnoses, when those rise and fall, you can see interesting patterns.
We get fed up maybe, or it's late in the day of a culture, or feels that way. Let me go to Victor in Buffalo, New York. Victor, you're on with Paris. Thanks for calling.
Tom, it's a pleasure to join the conversation. You know, we tend to be experts in ourselves, and my wife and I, we work together at the same company.
Yep.
We share administrative duties that we take home with us. We're raising 3 kids under 10 years of age.
Oh, boy.
And in the last month, we just buried the patriarch of our family, and we inherited the maintenance of his house and upkeep tending to my grandmother as well. And not to be lost, on the spiritual side, we also engage in weekly family worship and insist on doing volunteer work on the weekends as well as attending our congregation. So yeah. Just having this conversation made me appreciate that I haven't even thought about how exhausted I am, nor do I much have the time to do so.
Does it feel more mental, physical, spiritual? How do you sense it, Victor?
Well, I'm taking a work break right now just to start stacking wood materials into a trailer, and I'll be doing administrative duties later on, and one of our congregation meetings is tonight. So I think it's all of the above. I look at some of our family members that in years past worked 2 full-time jobs, and when they came home, they were the term that I use, exhausted, because they were physically spent.
Yeah.
But that's not to take away from the mental challenges that we face, as well as the day-to-day life experiences that we face. I suppose it's how well we're engaged with what we're doing. If we're challenging ourselves and we find something gratifying in what we do, I suppose it can be worn as a badge of honor. At the same time, if we'd like to have more time for ourselves, how do we view our circumstances?
Yeah, Victor, I love your call. I can hear you're trying to give us a pep talk in the middle of that very heavy load of things you've also simply have to do. And who can blame you for seeing exhaustion in there? On a standby in Paris, Dr. Alex Lickerman joins us right now, general internist in private practice, author of The Undefeated Mind. Dr. Lickerman, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
There's a caller from Buffalo, New York, who says, look, listen to the litany of things I have to do. Is it any wonder I'm exhausted? I mean, there must be limits to the human capacity for dynamic engagement. We have to end up exhausted sometimes.
Well, I think we do. In my profession, I make a differentiation between sort of normal exhaustion that occurs as a result of just using your body or your mind, and then pathologic exhaustion, exhaustion that interferes with life, and that's sort of where I do most of my work.
When you say pathologic, does that necessarily mean that it's a medical issue or something else?
Well, I guess no. Pathologic meaning it's at a degree that's so out of the ordinary that it interferes with life. And there's many, many causes to that type of fatigue, from the most common, which is inadequate sleep, to diseases that we well understand, like hypothyroidism or anemia, to diseases we don't understand the cause of, like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia.
You're a practicing Buddhist. You bring that into your work in The Undefeated Mind. Do you see this as more a matter of, you know, physical pathology, lack of sleep, or something larger, cultural, spiritual?
You know, it really depends. It's a total mix. Everyone is different. I think all of those things exist. And I think also people will confuse exhaustion or fatigue with other things like anxiety or depression, which are very commonly very common in our society and often present as fatigue. People don't always know, believe it or not, that they're anxious or depressed and think they're just fatigued.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about human beings and exhaustion. What's going on when we're wiped out? How humans have understood, perceived exhaustion across the centuries. Anna-Katrina Schaffner is with us from Paris. Her new book is Exhaustion, A History, and she takes it back, way back, to the ancients and says, look, humans have always complained about it. Dr. Alex Lickerman is with us, general internist, doctor in private practice. He's author of The Undefeated Mind on the Science of Constructing an Indestructible Self. Practicing Buddhist, indestructible self sounds pretty good, pretty challenging too. You can join us this hour. Is it straightforward with you? Too little sleep, you're wiped out? Or is it psychological, circumstantial, cultural, in the wrong frame of mind, you're exhausted no matter what? What about spiritual exhaustion? Do some of us need a deeper kind of revival? 2002 film The Hours, Nicole Kidman plays author Virginia Woolf, one of many authors diagnosed with neurasthenia, a form of ill-defined exhaustion popular in the medical world in the late 19th, early 20th century. Woolf was, in fact, forced to have rest cures. Here in a conversation with her husband Leonard, she pushes back against her treatment. She wants back into the thick of life.
If I were thinking clearly, Leonard, I would tell you that I wrestle alone in the dark, in the deep dark, and that only I can know, only I can understand my own condition. You live with the threat, you tell me, you live with the threat of my extinction. Leonard, I live with it too. This is my right. It is the right of every human being. I choose not the suffocating anesthetic of the suburbs, but the violent jolt of the capital. That is my choice.
Well, Virginia Woolf struggling there, but the rest cure is not what she wanted. Mindy in Homeworth, Ohio. Mindy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. My husband and I demonstrate sort of an interesting irony where we were part of the corporate world for about 26 years. We're in our 60s.
Okay.
And we always had this driving urge to become farmers. It was in our blood.
As if that would be very restful, so, Mindy.
Yes, exactly. And we had this grand design that we were going to be sustainable and, you know, just do it minimally so that we could survive. Obviously, we had a nice little nest egg. Well, 8 years hence now, we are at the top of our game. We are grossing over $200,000 in sales, and we have two employees. And I've never
on a farm, describe, you mean you're farming, Mindy, and you're making money at it, and it's going.
You're making money, and yet our sense was that this would be the most idyllic thing for us to sort of rescue us from the corporate world.
Yeah.
And in fact, we became as driven at it, my husband in particular, as we possibly were, even more so when he was in the corporate world.
But are you here to tell us that because it's organic farming, it's tremendously revitalizing and you're never exhausted for a moment? It's so delightful.
Not at all. Everybody looks at us and says, you're living the dream, and has no concept. At I have not ever experienced a kind of fatigue and exhaustion before. And as a matter of fact, midway through, everything did kind of come crashing in. I had a breakdown. My husband and I almost divorced. I mean, it was just the stress and work and drive and never being able to say no to people who wanted all of our beautiful produce was absolutely doing us in. So we revamped, but I'm here to say that in October we plan on retiring and really start living life. But it has been the most stressful, most exhausting experience we could possibly imagine. We're proud of it, but I don't know if I'd ever recommend it to anyone. And I guess I forewarn anybody who thinks that going back to the land and thinking that they can try to sell what they produce is going to make a living. I caution them.
Okay, Mindy, we've got it on Homeworth, Iowa. Anna-Katrina Schaffner there. You know, we like to think that certain kinds of exertion are so, pure or in line with natural rhythms, that though the work may be hard, the exhaustion is almost welcome and uplifting. Mindy says, be careful. Maybe organic farming may not get you there.
Yeah, I think that it's a very interesting story. Because when you're autonomous, when your own fate is in your own hands, that comes with another kind of stress. That basically means that you are responsible for your own luck. You're responsible for your own enterprise, and your finances are in your hands. So you have to perform. You have to make it work. And because there's nobody there who tells you what to do and when, that can actually that can build up and become a massive pressure factor in one's life.
Who's going to pick the peppers out there? Somebody has to bring them in. Let me go to David in Avon Lake, Ohio, if I may. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Love your show. I just felt the need to chime in as a practicing Shaolin martial artist for almost 40 years.
Kung Fu. Got it.
Yeah, has your guest looked into and researched the Shaolin lifestyle? Because you don't see Shaolin warriors walking around tired, they're lightning bolts of energy, and it's from a knowledge of all the aspects of life, the mind-body connection, the spirit, everything is included in it, even sexual behavior. And I just wonder, it's a gold mine of energy for balancing yourself. You don't have to be a martial artist to apply the principles.
You're talking about exercise and a rigorous life. I don't know if you sleep on a bed of nails or any of that. So I'm not sure of your school of Shaolin. And then watching every aspect of diet and behavior, even sexual and so on. You're saying you can work it out so that exhaustion is banished?
Yeah, I mean, if you were to put it simply, it really comes down to an awareness of whether you're managing the outflow of your energy or you're managing the buildup of it. And just being honest about that and making appropriate choices. I mean, it doesn't have to be rigorous, intense.
Yeah.
It just has to be self-honesty, really, is what it comes down to.
David, I so appreciate your call. Alec Lickerman, how about it? I mean, you've got your book. You're talking about on the science of constructing an indestructible self. That sounds kind of Shaolin Kung Fu right there. You've got a Buddhist background as well, which, of course, a lot of Kung Fu has some ties there. What do you think of this notion of Shaolin, a managing of energies as a way of escaping this cycle of exhaustion?
Well, I think the two callers are conflating two things which people commonly do, which is exhaustion and stress. And it's well known that one's subjective sense of energy correlates well with their core affect, meaning how much joy they're feeling or how much suffering they're experiencing. And so to imagine Shaolin practitioners walking around not exhausted, my guess is it's more comes from the fact that they're managing their stress well. And in fact, that's, the thesis of my book is that, resilience, meaning the ability to manage stress and through that exhaustion, the kind of exhaustion we've been talking about, is not something that you are either just lucky enough to be born with or unlucky enough to be born without. But something that we can all take very specific steps to improve and increase, whether we believe in the practice of Buddhism or Shaolin or any other practice whatsoever. It's by leveraging certain psychological facts about ourselves.
Steps like what, Dr. Lickerman?
So, for example, one of the principles I talk about in the book, and again, this is based on more research than it is Buddhist philosophy, and is the notion of how we view pain. There's a chapter in the book called Accept Pain, and the idea is basically this. So when we evolved, we evolved an aversion to physical pain because, of course, that keeps us alive.
Yep.
You put your hand in a fire and it burns, you pull your hand away and you survive. Mm-hmm. But when we evolved further and developed frontal lobes and developed sentience and self-awareness, we took our aversion to pain into the psychological world. And we all, if you think about it, spend all of our days every day doing things to avoid what you might consider to be legitimate pain, whether it's not answering an email with someone who you're going to have a conflict or not making a phone call, or perhaps trying to assuage your own pain about what's going on in your life with drugs and alcohol, or perhaps trying to avoid accomplishing something you really want to accomplish because the thought of taking it on and taking on the tasks you would need to accomplish would be too painful. Mm-hmm. And so the notion here is that we have this idea now in our society that we are never supposed to feel bad. We're never supposed to feel anxious. We're never supposed to feel exhausted. And if we do, people come and ask me as a doctor, give me a pill for this. And what I'm suggesting in the book is that when you look at pain, whether that is anxiety or your exhaustion or anger or guilt or physical pain, from the perspective of acceptance, it has a very strange and paradoxical effect. It actually reduces the level of intensity of whatever you're feeling. So, for example, people who are trying to quit smoking and have nicotine cravings or trying to lose weight and have hunger cravings, even epileptics who will often get a warning sign that a seizure is about to come on with some very unpleasant sensations, if they – all those people – view those unpleasant sensations with acceptance, invariably what happens is the studies show they have a higher rate of quitting smoking, a higher rate of successfully losing weight, and even a lower rate of seizures. There is something about saying to yourself when there's an unpleasant sensation coming, again, whether it's anxiety or exhaustion, whatever, rather than, I can't handle this, say instead, bring it on.
Wait,
you're
are you
sort
saying
of implicitly
to
saying to yourself.
No, to avoid exhaustion or to just live in it and say, this is fine.
Yeah. So again, if it's not a pathological exhaustion that represents some disease process and you have an activity you have to complete and you're tired, when you say to yourself, yeah, I'm tired, but I accept I'm tired, bring it on, I'm still going to attack this problem. In a sense, we're saying to ourselves, we're strong enough to keep going. And the studies show in different contexts that really makes a difference in how well we perform and also how we experience that exhaustion or that anxiety or that food craving or nicotine craving.
Anna-Katrina Scheffner, I wonder how you're thinking about that, sitting listening in Paris. I mean, maybe if the Germans, fellow Germans you talk to who are walking around feeling exhausted or worried about it, maybe they took on some different practice of life or mental attitudes. Maybe if they became Shaolin Kung Fu fighters, they'd have more energy.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thought. I mean, I wonder with my cultural historical hat on, you know, when the other guests would date that phenomenon that we've become that we've developed an aversion to psychological pain. I think it's a trend, in fact, to talk about resilience. And at the moment, there's a whole industry out there that is trying to make people more resilient. And critics from the left would argue that this whole resilience talk is really a phenomenon that is related to redirecting responsibility for one's well-being to the individual and taking it away from the state, for example.
You mean you're in a bad system, but instead of addressing the system, you work on your personal stuff.
Exactly. So that it becomes your responsibility to develop resilience. Of course, developing resilience is not a bad thing. That's not what I'm saying. But there is, I think, a very, very noticeable trend to redirect responsibility back to the individual. The mindfulness boom, for example, has something to do with that as well. It's in your hands. You can basically work on your own welfare. You can manage your energy resources in a better way, and then you will be fine. And then other critics would, of course, say that, you know, that there something needs to change about our working environment. Something needs to be done about, you know, the factors that make us so exhausted in the first place. So it's an interesting debate.
Very, Dr. Lickerman, what about it? This, you say change yourself. Anna-Katrina Scheffner says perhaps change the culture or the system or the politics and you're more likely to feel less oppressed by exhaustion.
Well, I think it's both. I don't think it has to be either or. Mm-hmm. And I think there's room for both solutions. Certainly in my practice and with readers who I've talked about, most people, I don't know most, but many people really struggle just to manage the difficulty of their own lives. And so certainly that has a lot to do with the systems in which they work and the countries and the cultures in which they work, but also even the most oppressive regimes, there are always things that people can do themselves to bolster their resilience and enable them to withstand whatever it is they're feeling, exhaustion, anxiety, or whatever.
Dan writes to us on Twitter, the cult of productivity is to blame now. People jog while listening to podcasts, I guess, to make productive use of that time, glued to their devices the rest of the time. Of course, here at NPR, we embrace podcasts and celebrate them. Listen anywhere you like. But Anna, this is kind of related to what you're saying, late stage capitalism, cult of productivity. Maybe we wear ourselves out by thinking every minute has to be producing something.
Absolutely. I think when time was beginning to be measured, you know, when clock time was introduced and the idea that we all need to be very productive in, you know, as a result of the Industrial Revolution, time became a very, very precious commodity that was not to be squandered, that was not to be wasted. And people really, I think, internalized that. And, you know, especially Max Weber has quite a lot to say about that with the Protestant work ethic. And how, you know, how being productive has become a value in itself, one that we don't often question. So the cult of productivity, I think, has a lot to do with our exhaustion levels, absolutely. But there's also an interesting debate to be had about what else one can do and in what ways one can foster one's own energy reserves. And I think what I find really interesting and important is that it's not about one size fits all theories, but it's about understanding what energizes you and what drains you. And everyone is different because, for example, introverts might find socializing really, really draining. It's hard work for them to chat and to small talk. And they might find that a really, really anxiety-inducing and stressful experience, whilst extroverts, they would gain energy from being with people. So, you know, so it's very much about knowing what works for you on a very personal level.
Find your own zone of what the life that energizes.
Absolutely.
What an interesting exploration. Do you buy overall that culturally we're at a moment that encourages it more, or you really do see this as a steady state through time, Anna?
I do think that, you know, that a lot of contemporary phenomena are very exhausting, absolutely. You know, working arrangements are becoming ever more precarious. Sociologists also like to talk about the flip side of autonomy. You know, we've become much more autonomous in our working environments. We can manage our own time, we can work from home and so on, but that comes with great responsibility. And as a result, many of us feel constantly lacking. We constantly feel that we don't really live up to the expectations. So we have to realize ourselves. We have to be happy, productive people. But the responsibility is very much on our shoulders, and that can be a terrible kind of freedom that can paralyze us and can make us feel like losers, basically, when we don't live up to our high expectations.
At the same time, you remind us in a comforting way that over the sweep of history, we have lots of fellow feeling, lots of company feeling exhausted. Dr. Alex Lickerman's book is The Undefeated Mind, on the science of constructing an indestructible self. Dr. Lickerman, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Anna-Katrina Schaffner, Exhaustion, A History, really fascinating excerpt at our website. Thank you for joining us, Anna.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.